ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. As we go to air this afternoon, there's a bunch of cattle stations in the top end battling fires. And there's a lot of country getting burnt to the south of Katherine, it would seem. So I'll be speaking to Bushfires NT in just a moment to get the latest information for you. Also this afternoon, you'll hear from one of the legends of the NT's mango industry, Ken Rayner. Ken's in his 90s and he is still tinkering away on potential new mango varieties.
Very few people do mango breeding because of the long time it takes to get a result. You wouldn't rarely ever get a result less than 20 years.
What is Ken working on at the moment? You'll find out soon. Also this afternoon, you'll get to join the 100th birthday party of Australia's rice industry.
Oh, everything has all changed and got bigger and quicker, and that headers are all got bigger. It was all in bag days in those early days where it's all bulk now.
All these stories and plenty more coming up this afternoon on the Country Hour. Hope you can stick around. We're broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC. We're streaming online, and g'day there if you've tuned in via the podcast. First up this afternoon, I've got a story for you about flying fish. Humpty Doo Barramundi has doubled its export sales in the last couple of years, including a new deal to send Barra into Japan for the first time. The farm says it's on track to supply about 12 tonnes to the World Expo that's being held in Osaka. And if all goes to plan, there'll be plenty of demand and new deals to be made in Japan after that event. To learn more, I had a chat to Dan Richards. His family are the ones that own and run Humpty Doo Barra.
We've been working on the export space for the last 10 years and prior to COVID, established markets into Singapore and Hong Kong. So we're going into premium venues there, which is wonderful to see. And then this year, we've really seen a lot of interest in other markets into our, premium Humpty Doo Barramundi out of the Northern Territory. So the first part of that was the, Humpty Doo Barramundi is now representing Australia at the Australia Pavilion at World Expo in Osaka. So they're doing 20,000 meals a week through the Australia Pavilion, and the World Expo is expected to see 30 million people come through the gates. So that's a wonderful opportunity to represent, the best of Australian seafood on a world stage. So we're really honoured to have that opportunity and seeing, great success and volumes going through to World Expo.
So how often are you flying fish to Japan for that?
It's sort of doing weekly shipments at the moment. Good volume. So they started small and grew quickly, and now it's pretty stable. So it's been really good. We're working with a processing partner to get the product over there in the right format, and that's going really well and being really well received as well. So they're doing a classic Australian fish and chips with the Barramundi, as well as using it extensively in the VIP dining area.
Have you been over there yet to see this in action firsthand?
A couple of my people have. I'm going to join the NT trade mission up to Osaka in September, so next month. So really exciting to be part of that.
So after the World Expo ends in October sometime, what's your hopes for the Japanese market post the event?
That's really the big question. So, we're doing a push to see, can we build other premium markets up there in Japan? It's a great stage and to be showing our fish, and it's great to have that logistics, operation in place to get the product up there. So now it's about getting it in front of as many chefs and key end users as possible, so that hopefully beyond World Expo, it'll continue.
And what are the logistics like? Because it's not like we have direct flights from Humpty Doo to Osaka.
No, absolutely. So at the moment, we're shipping the fish to Brisbane. They're getting processed, cryovac'd, and then sent up via air freight up to Osaka. So we've got a traditional Japanese importer who's been a really important part of that chain to ensure that product gets up there. So there's a few steps in the chain with the lack of wide body aircraft going north from Darwin, but that's it. We're still able to get our premium Australian seafood up there.
Yeah, no doubt. Long term, you'd love to be going direct out of at least Darwin to Singapore.
Oh, look, it would be great. I mean, we are already shipping on the narrow body aircraft, product directly from Darwin to Singapore.
Right.
But it's just about ensuring that guarantee that cold chain all the way through. At the moment, we've got a flight that's going directly to Japan from Australia. So it's all part of the journey. So that's going really well. And we're also seeing increasing interest for our unique Australian provenance barramundi into the USA market, which is also really exciting.
Oh, wow. So with these export markets, are they after anything different compared to the domestic sales?
For sure. I mean, this is we're really looking at discerning premium markets who are looking for a product with unique attributes, around qualities, consistency, provenance, sustainability, and ethical operation. Australian produce has great credentials, around compliance and safety and the like, so that's really important. But it's also, you've really got to be in premium market because, golly, there's a lot of other cheap protein in the world. So this isn't about cheap. This is about something special that we're able to send, the taste of the territory to the world.
You're up against Asian sea bass, I guess, in these markets, aren't you?
Certainly. And lamb and pork and beef and chicken and tofurkey and 200 species of other fish. So, this is, humans have a lot of, are great at producing things and they have a lot of choice. So, it's really about for us finding those premium markets who will pay for a premium Australian product and then getting that product in front of them and explaining the points of difference and letting them taste it for themselves. And what we find is when people eat our fish, they come back for more. So that is exciting.
Can the margins be better in the export market?
Look, it's probably more volatile than the domestic market. I mean, we are very much a domestic market focused producer and we produce over half the barramundi coming out of Australia, so that domestic is our core business, but we are seeing this growing demand for this for premium high value niche products out of the Northern Territory.
And just on Japan, is there any interest in using Humpty Doo barra for sushi and for sashimi?
For sure. Well, we're certainly seeing, our product being used here in Australia through Sushi Izu's, the largest sushi chain in Australia. And it's owned by a Japanese company that has 10,000 sushi stores globally. We're really excited to see, to be working with Sushi Izu here in Australia to really, this is a world first to have a national sushi chain pick up barramundi and using Humpty Doo barramundi as their flagship brand into a whole new category. So it's really exciting for us to be working with a quality partner like Sushi Izu, or AFC is their Australian company name. And it's really exciting. And then to see that open up opportunities globally is wonderful.
Have you had time to sit down with the family and reflect on this journey from supplying a few barra to the local market to now going to all kinds of spots around the world?
Oh, look, we do a little bit, but we're a little bit more focused on what's next.
Yep.
Rather than spending too much time patting ourselves on the back, there's always more work to do. We can all, we're fanatical about learning and improving. So we're constantly, taking feedback, refining our processes, perfecting our products and our services, and really just driving that improvement piece, which is really critical to be successful in these global markets.
I've enjoyed learning about flying barramundi on the country out today. Dan, thanks so much for your time.
No, thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Humpty Doo Barra, being sent to Singapore, Hong Kong, the Middle East, the United States, and now Japan. Not bad for an operation, a family-run operation out the back of Humpty Doo. If you're tuning in, this is the Country Hour. Matt Brown with you this afternoon. It is 20 to 1. I see on the Weather Bureau's website this afternoon there is a strong wind warning in place for the Arafura Coast and the Ropa Groot Coast. And here at the Country Hour, we have received a message from SeaLink, which is wishing to advise that today's Groot Bickerton ferry service is cancelled due to these high winds and the sea conditions out there. So SeaLink says it'll provide updates when that changes. But at the moment, for those out that way, just be aware that the Groot to Bickerton ferry service has been cancelled.
Yeah, g'day, how you going? My name's Jason Moon, owner of MT Tropical Passion Fruit. We're on the farm today, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
It is a bit blowy out there this afternoon, which is also creating some nasty conditions for those fighting fires. Yesterday, I drove from Kununurra in the Kimberley right through to Darwin, and gee, the smoke around the Katherine region was really noticeable. There's still some big fires to the south of town. So up next, let's have a chat to Bushfires NT and get the latest information and find out what is going on. Before that, a tune. I heard this bloke perform on Saturday night in Kununurra. He hails from the Halls Creek region. He's one of the all-time great songwriters of the north, I reckon. His name is Peter Brandy. This is one of my favourite tunes of his. It's called Have You Ever? I hope you enjoy it. To be Australian. That is Peter Brandy and the song Have You Ever? Right across the territory on the ABC, you're tuned into the Country Hour. Now, fires have been burning south of Katherine for almost 2 weeks now. And judging from the NAFI website this afternoon, it would seem poor old Mambaloo Station has lost a lot of cow food. We're joined this afternoon by David Bredmore, who is the incident controller with Bushfires NT. Afternoon to you, David.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I am well. Tell us about the weekend and how things are faring in terms of these fires to the south of Katherine.
Yes. Well, we've had some news on the Elsie fire this afternoon that shows that it has broken some containment lines along the highway. We put some aircraft over that this morning and our crews are working down there, and they, I'm very pleased to report, have contained the forward spread of that fire, and we'll be moving the spot over that's on the eastern side of the highway to under control or contained probably within the next hour. So that is good news. And that will protect, of course, Mambaloo Station.
Yeah. Is there much of a team on Mambaloo at the moment to help with this effort to fight the fire?
Yes, there's a full mustering team on site, and they've got some machines in place. So they are firming up their containment lines. And, of course, we're working on the head of that fire at the moment.
What are the wind conditions like? Because over the last week or so, it has been a bit blowy, especially in the morning.
Yeah, look, we're experiencing right across both the Savannah and the top end some increased fire season activity. Of course, you know we had extreme fire conditions here in the Darwin and Adelaide River area over the weekend, and that resulted in a number of fires. And then we've got this strong southeasterly airflow, which of course is pushing everything to the northwest. And we're seeing it elevated wind speeds in that up to 45 kilometres an hour. And it's generally in the mornings. And then the inversion layer lifts and it picks up a bit by the afternoon.
Yeah, again, I'm just going off the NAFI website here. You can see a fire that looks like it originated on Victoria River Downs cattle station, but boom, just blown up into the northwest and into the national park, it would seem.
Yeah, look, sometimes NAFI can be a little bit deceiving in the way that it doesn't necessarily represent uncontrolled fire. Sometimes it will demonstrate or show areas where we are actually using backing fire to contain fire. So it can be a little bit misleading, but you're right, that one has made a bit of a run, and it is, however, it is in the containment stages at the moment.
Okay. Just going back to the fire at Manbaloo and for residents around Katherine, who no doubt, yeah, there's plenty of smoke around the air. There was yesterday afternoon when I was in town. What do people in the region need to know about that fire and just how things are faring along the Vic Highway in particular?
Yeah, look, that's very astute of you to pick that up, Matt, because we have issued a number of health warnings in relation to our advice messages, particularly those people that might be susceptible to respiratory illnesses and the like. So you do need to be conscious of the smoke drift. It is going to continue for some time while we're under this southeasterly airstream, and we will see a bit of that drifting across highways and roadways. And so we do ask people to take care, to drive to the conditions, to put their headlights on, and be conscious of the fact that there'll be emergency services personnel active on all of those road systems.
And any other fires that you'd like our audience to be aware of this afternoon, David?
Look, we've got 15, as I said, we've got 15 advice messages up. We do have a fire burning in Bachelor at the moment, which we have managed to contain, but that has been difficult for us. And we've got 2 helicopters and 4 firebombing aircraft working on that, along with volunteer and staff crews. So that's been a bit of a concern. And we had a fire on the down near the Douglas Daily across the Stuart Highway there that popped up last night that gave us some concern, and we did send some crews out to that. But other than that, all I ask that people keep an eye on social media and on Secure NT, our Facebook page, the Northern Territory Fire Incident Map, and, of course, listen to you guys. And we'll try and keep you updated as best as we can. We need to be conscious of it all the way through this week. High fire danger throughout the entire week.
Thanks for keeping us up to date this afternoon. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
That is David Bredmore, who's the Incident Controller at Bushfires NT. A lot of people working hard to bring that blaze under control to the south of Katherine this afternoon. It is 9 to 1. Just outside of Katherine, right near that Victoria Highway, is a big mango farm that is owned by Manbaloo Mangoes. The farm manager there is Trevor Nelson. He says it's always a bit of a nervous time of year when fires start to flare up just prior to their harvest. He told Christine Schindler they're keeping a close eye on the weather at the moment.
I was over there yesterday again, and I've seen that it's starting to burn away from the orchard and keeping everyone safe and the Manbaloo station safe, which is good. So great job to everyone that's involved in that.
Does it look like you're out of danger as well, or is it still too early to tell?
Still too early to tell, because, you know, fire is fire. It can go wherever it wants. Definitely always a danger time of the year up in the Territory.
You have fought some fires in your time. Can you tell me about one of them?
Yeah. So I've been involved in fires for a fairly long time now, and always done controlled burns around the place and helped other people do controlled burns. But last year, on the 28th of September, as a lot of people know, the fire jumped the river into Ballingilly onto Florina Roadside, and that took a good week of fighting and a lot of great teamwork from all other stations, the fire brigade, the rural fire from town, you know, up in the sky people, everyone done an awesome job. And if they didn't do what they'd done, and the team didn't do what they'd done with me, and we would have lost a hell of a lot. And that's another big thank you again for what everyone done last year to help out Ballingilly and all the other stations around this place.
Yeah, you said you had to put your tools down and pick up the tractors and take them out to fight the fire. Can you tell me what happened there?
Oh, look, at 12, 20 past 12, you know, we'd been watching it from the day before. Once that wind had picked up and the heat in the wind being into the build-up, it was just like a war zone, and everyone acted really good, and we had tractors ready for harvest, but we just got out there and fought it with the fires, and yeah, very good teamwork. And then Fire Brigade, NT Fireys had come in and gave us a big hand, and then everyone around from other stations also come in and gave us a big hand. And yeah, definitely without the help that they'd done, it would have been disaster.
That is Trevor Nelson from Mambaloo Mangoes, keeping a close eye on the weather at the moment. And he was speaking to Christine Schindler there about last year, big fire getting very close to the company's farm near Katherine. It is that time of the year, isn't it, in the Northern Territory. Speaking of mangoes, I was away last week and was pretty chuffed to jump onto ABC Rural's website and see the news that the Northern Territory and WA governments have agreed to a fruit fly management protocol that will allow territory mangoes to go across the border and into WA markets. I know the industry had been getting very nervous about this, but the deal has been done. If you missed the chat with Sally Heaton, the Chief Plant Health Officer, she was on the program last week. Have a little listen to this.
Yes, it is wonderful news. Over the last couple of years, the mango season for accessing to Western Australia has been a little bit uncertain with a few changes that have happened with chemical treatments and pathway. But what we've managed to do in time for this upcoming season is to have our agreement, which was used to be known as CTM01 for Western Australia, approved and endorsed as what's known as a Interstate Certification Assurance Protocol. So for growers on the ground, it's still the same process, but it's a nationally endorsed certification assurance protocol that's been approved by a national committee. It's recognised, and it gives us some long-term sustainability for access into Western Australia.
That is Sally Heaton on the Country Hour last week, and you can read more about this news if you head along to the NT Country Hour's website. Indiana Station, which is about 150 kilometres to the east of Alice Springs, it is flat out mustering at the moment. Liz Bird is there and says all is going well, and she says the cattle are looking beautiful after a run of good seasons.
At the moment, they're at a bore called Bogaduck, and which is aptly named because it's sort of when it gets wet out there, it will bog a duck. So they're out there mustering. They'll be moving camp soon back to another bore called number 12. And so we only do one round here at Indiana, but most stations do too. We got held up with a bit of rain that was came along in June, so that sort of slowed down movements out east to trap for the cattle. So we had a bit of a break between Fink and the show, and then Hart's Range. So now pulled up again and back into it. So there's just got another couple of weeks to go, and then we'll be finished.
So it's just a couple more weeks of work, and that will be your mustering done for 2025?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. We don't have huge numbers. We don't have huge crew. We don't have to do a lot. But, yeah, we've only got a couple more bores to do, and then we'll be finished for 2025. And then we'll get together some sale cattle, some fats, and they'll head off to the abattoirs.
You mentioned that movement of cattle. There are no cattle currently on the move from Indiana, but you're looking to get them onto some trucks soon?
Yeah, probably in September. We usually sell down south to the abattoirs, whether it be Murray Bridge, Narrow Court, sometimes over into Victoria. That's usually what we do. Sometimes steers go over to Queensland over near Toowoomba Way. It just depends where we're organic, so it depends on where the organic market is.
Are you getting much of an indication right now of where that organic market might be for you right now?
No, not really. My husband's pretty much of an ad hoc. As we need to clear them off, we get rid of them, and our agent does a great job of finding a home for them. So we don't tend to look too closely at the prices and things. It's just, it's more to do with when we need to get rid of them, as far as looking after the land and fitting in with our schedule.
More broadly, how has the season been out there at Indiana Station, and how's the country looking?
At Indiana, it's been very good, actually, for the last probably 5 years at least. We've had, if we haven't had a wet summer, we've had rain in the winter, so we've had good rains every calendar year. So we've had a good supply of grass. If anything, it's always our underground water that we struggle with in summer, but, you know, as long as we get rid of the cattle that we need to get rid of, then we're not carrying too many head and we're fine over summer. We were lucky enough to get about 8 inches in March, April, because we had rain that came from Queensland, and then we had, then there was a front that came across from Western Australia, which hit Alice Springs, and then we scored another couple of inches from that. So this year we actually scored rain from both sides of the country.
You mentioned you've had a half decade run of good years now. That must be a bit of a rarity for you as a pastoralist.
Well, it is. I mean, I've only been here 30 years, and it seemed before that to be every 10 years we'd have a series of two or three good years. But, yeah, the last few years have been very, very good. So we'll still need to keep an eye out for bushfires and that the threat of lightning and any dry storms later on in the year. But we're hoping that if any fires that do start, they won't carry for too far.
That's Liz Bird speaking to Charles Geary from Indiana Station in Central Australia. Only been there 30 years. I like that. Got to go to the newsroom. See you back here in 5 minutes' time for a chat with the Weather Bureau.
G'day, it's Jeff Tucker from the Sydney Fish Market, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. Big thanks to Fiona Broom for looking after the program while I was out and about last week. In a moment, you'll get to hear from NT mango industry legend Ken Rayner. Ken's in his 90s and is still tinkering away on potential new mango varieties.
Very few people do mango breeding because of the long time it takes to get a result. You wouldn't really ever get a result less than 20 years.
You'll also get to join the 100th birthday party of Australia's rice industry. And I'll be telling you soon about a program that's doing some really great things for our bush students. This is all coming up before 1:30. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Billy Lynch is there this afternoon. How are you, Billy?
Hey, Matt. I'm great. Thanks.
We spoke to Bushfires NT a moment ago about some of the fires that are causing the pastoral country a lot of trouble. There's a fair bit of fire in the landscape this afternoon. What are conditions like? What should people be aware of?
Well, so it's really classic dry season conditions today. Strong high, south of the Bight. Fresh and gusty southeasterly winds, you know, through central parts and up into the top end. So, a lot of locations in the last few hours, we've seen wind speeds of up to around 30 k's per hour, gusts 40, if not 50 k's per hour. Wind's just starting to ease back now, as they do at this time of year, once we hit the afternoon. But the other thing's the really dry air, the humidity very low at the moment. Those two things make fires difficult to control.
And do you see a break in that pattern at all in the coming days?
It's a very slow-moving pattern. So, you know, the ridge across the Northern Territory really remains in place for most of the week, with just a gradual easing. So conditions tomorrow will be similar to conditions today. And then from Wednesday onwards, the winds will just slowly decrease. But basically for this week, we've just got those dry southeasterly winds pushing right throughout the territory.
There's a strong wind warning in place for the Arafura Coast and the Roper Group Coast. How long are you expecting that to last for?
Well, that will continue tomorrow, and then winds will ease below the warning thresholds from Wednesday. but winds will still be, you know, at least 15 to 20 knots across most of our coastal waters for the remainder of the week.
Rightio. I'm buying up big on chapsticks at the moment. I've sort of spent the last week out in the Kimberley, and the old lips are copping it with the wind. Let's talk about Central Australia. What do people in the centre need to be aware of?
I mean, it's very settled through there. No rain to speak of. It's a fair bit of high cloud south of Alice Springs. So not perfectly blue skies, but certainly no rainfall. Below average temperatures. So you have risk of frost through parts of the Simpson and the Lassiter district. And that's about it. Temperatures gradually warming up towards the end of the week.
Easy as that. Anything else we should be aware of?
No, that's about it, Matt.
Beauty. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Add some colour and life to your garden. Get tips on growing classic annuals, flannel flowers, potted fruit trees, blueberries and bird-friendly plants. It's all in Gardening Australia magazine from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
It is 1:09 and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Ken Rayner is a legend of Australia's mango industry. He's based in Katherine and he has spent decades developing new mango varieties. For example, it was Ken's select breeding that led to the Lady Jane and Lady Grace mangoes, a couple of delicious mangoes right there. And at 93 years of age, Ken is still tinkering away on his farm and says he's got 14 different varieties currently being tested for commercialisation. He told Christine Schindler that mangoes are never an overnight success.
Very few people do mango breeding because of the long time it takes to get a result. You would rarely ever get a result less than 20 years. So it's there and it's got to be fiddled to get what you want.
And what are the traits that the mangoes variety that are getting tested now, what are the traits like?
Well, they're like what everybody's looking for, the sweet fruit, good shape and colour and size and small seed. And I can't see any reason that we won't get something out of the ones being tested at the present time.
And of those varieties that you have that are being tested, how long will it take for them to be commercialised?
Well, when we know what the capacity is for quality and so forth, then we'll take it to plant breeders' rights and so we can get it onto the market. But it's a long time from having one tree marketable, whereas you've got to get the trees and the tree numbers that you want, you've got to have some thousands of trees grafted up and planted to get what you want.
Do you think any of the varieties that you're being tested now, you'll be able to eat any of them in the future?
I've eaten most of them already.
And how do they taste?
Most of them are good. That's why they were being tested now. Appearance is one of the big things that make them popular. Material. The flavour, the colour and so forth. The more flesh you can get on from the seed, away from the seed, the more flesh you can have to eat. So yeah, it's a hit and miss game all around. Yeah.
When you have that variety, how do you name them? How do you choose the names?
I don't choose the name, and I don't intend to start now, but there's plenty of people around willing to put their name on something. Yeah.
And how many varieties do you have here at the farm?
Oh, it'll be somewhere in the vicinity of 500 or 600. Might be a bit more, might be more than that. Yeah, I've never actually counted them. So, you know, they're trees and got to be looked after, and each tree is treated as an individual. It's not a row of cabbages sort of thing. It's tree by tree by tree. So that's the way you've got to go. Mm.
And how are the flowers looking?
There's a good, real good flowering, and we've just got to see what the results are at the end of the flowering season. Mm. Yeah, nobody can predict that with any accuracy until such time as they see the result.
That is mango breeder Ken Rayner, legend of the industry, 93 years of age, still tinkering away on that potential new variety for the industry. It's 13 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Up next, you'll be hearing from the organisation that's called Raise Education. It'll be telling you about the work it's doing at the moment to help our bush kids and their families.
My name's Shelby.
And my name's Annalise.
And we're growing vegetables and herbs at our school's garden. You are listening to the Country Hour.
If you've got young kids and you live in town, then dropping them off to preschool or daycare, that's a fairly common, often daily occurrence. But what happens if you're raising a young family on a remote cattle station? Well, the organisation that's called Raise Education, it's running a number of playgroups across remote territory communities and stations at the moment to give bush kids a chance to actually hang out with little friends their own age. Founder Kylie Jones spoke to Charles Geary about why these catch-ups are important, not just for the kids, but also the parents.
So the playgroups are a wonderful opportunity for remote families to come together, for kids to get to participate in early education opportunities, and also for parents to come together and catch up and have some time, especially when you're in these remote locations. It can be so hard to see others. I think it's so important for a social aspect to be able to connect with their peers and build those skills. And I think it's also important to have an opportunity where educators can see some of these kids and make sure everyone's on track developmentally. And we can also identify if there's any things that we need to look into further.
You mentioned skills and trying to identify things that may need to be looked into. What are some of those skills and key development milestones that being a part of a playgroup really allow educators to find out about?
I think a really key aspect we find is sort of speech development and not so much the traditional people thinking that they're not pronouncing words properly, but just that language development and do they have enough words? Are they broadening their vocabulary? So really making sure they're on track with that is probably a key area we look at.
Is that something that can be missed for kids growing up on stations with the isolation and maybe not interacting with other kids that often?
Yeah, definitely. And especially for families, it can be hard when you're not seeing other kids on a regular basis to know what is appropriate and where their child should be. So it's a great opportunity to connect and help kids along on those pathways.
And you mentioned earlier as well that these events and meetups and playgroups are not only important for the kids, but they're important for parents as well to be able to meet and talk to people in similar situations. Why do you find this to be so important for parents as well?
I think it can be really isolating in these environments, and raising your child is difficult at the best of times, but when you don't have those support networks. So I think to have someone there to just ask questions and feel like you've got some support in your corner is so valuable.
These playgroups were in pretty high demand from station families and from people living remotely. What was the gap they were filling? Were there many similar playgroups like this before Raise Education came through and started offering these?
No, for a very long time, Central Australia in particular has been a real dead zone for early education, and there's just been nothing on offer. So it's been exciting to be part of this with, I know the work of ICPA have really been backing and trying to support families and children and make sure playgroups are something they can access.
These in-person playgroups happen about, you get a few sessions in every year, but there is a bit of a gap. Do you have online sessions, online playgroups to help fill that gap in the meantime?
Yeah, so we've just started delivering an early education playgroup online, which involves weekly interactive lessons for the kids, and probably not so much lessons, but really fun ways to come together. It also supports parents. And once again, we have that access to health specialists like speechies and OTs to provide that support if we're seeing anything that's a little bit concerning or just needs a little bit more help.
We were chatting earlier, you mentioned these playgroups go for about 2 hours, or they're meant to. It seems like you're always out there a bit longer. There's real love for them once people get out and get to do these sessions.
Definitely, and sometimes come pack up time, it can be a real task to get the kids to want to pack things up. But I'm always keen to keep them running while kids are happy and playing. And I think, you know, when you make that effort to go to a remote area, that you want to give them as much support and time as you can.
And after these sessions are done, what more are you hoping to do? What are there any plans for the future to continue these playgroups going forward?
We're really working hard at the moment to find a sustainable source of funding to be able to deliver these on a regular basis and to provide more support for families, especially that early intervention side. So our biggest thing is finding that funding. So that's our plan moving forward, to make sure there's longevity in what we're delivering.
That is Kylie Jones, who's the founder of Raise Education, speaking to Charles Geary. And I've got here, there are two more playgroups to be run over the coming weeks. So there'll be one at the Bonya School on Oratipara. So that's on August 29. And then there's going to be one held in Alice Springs on September 16. So if you're interested, put that in the diary or get in contact with Kylie, and I'm sure she'll help you out. Our text number at the Country Hour is 0487 99 1057. I'll admit I've been having a little trouble with our text line this afternoon, so I hope I haven't missed anyone. I got a message from Angus, who loved our earlier song from Peter Brandy. He says, such a good song and a goosebump message to all of us here in the Territory and to the way of life. And Greg was listening to the conversation with Kenny Rayner, says maybe Ken could breed a tangy mango. I grew up with mangoes, says Greg. Do not really like the sweet ones. All right, Kenny, if you're listening, we need more tang. We need more tang. It's 20 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Up next, get out the birthday hat, because we're heading along to the 100th birthday of Australia's rice industry. Tim McGraw, Faith Hill, this is the Country Hour. Australia's rice industry is celebrating 100 years of commercial production and 75 years of the Rice Growers Cooperative Mills, which would go on to become SunRice. So in 1924, 8 farmers planted seed that had been brought in from California by the New South Wales government. That's how it all started back in the day. And as for the industry now, well, last season, Australia's rice industry produced $400 million worth of rice, with more than 500 growers supporting thousands of jobs. The Country Hour's Emily Dowick went along to a party in the Riverina where this milestone was being celebrated and caught up with a bunch of current growers, including one fella who's been growing rice for nearly 70 years.
John Walter from Tantanen, which is down a bit from Bunnaloo. I've been growing rice since 57, when I put the first crop in.
So 1957, so that's a fair stretch. What's kept you growing rice for that long?
You could grow rice on the place, and it was a good crop to grow. And you, with the rice industry, if they tell you they're going to give you so much money for your crop, you know what you're getting. A lot better than a lot of other things. You never know whether you're going to get $2 or $10 for it, where rice you do.
And what have been the biggest changes in the way that you grow the crop of rice in the time that you've been growing it?
Getting it ready. You're putting your banks up, and everything has all changed and got bigger and quicker, and that headers are all got bigger. It was all in bag days in those early days, where it's all bulk now.
You're using less water nowadays?
Yes, using less water, up until they brought in the new regulators.
And what about the season ahead for you? Are you looking at planting rice this year?
I'd like to, but we've got a 1% is all we've got in water now, so I can't grow rice on that.
Robert Andreazza from Wilbriggy, south of Griffith. First rice crop went in the ground in 1965. I've been on the farm since 1994.
Good industry to be involved in.
I look, fantastic industry. That's all I do, is I grow rice and wheat. Wheat goes to the Arnott's, and rice is an integral part of the business model. What we own in regarding land is all backed off on rice.
And so in the years that you've been growing since the 60s for the family there, have you seen much change in the way the crop's produced?
Oh, massive change. Water wasn't a problem. Now it's a big, big part of the decision making. We've only missed one crop in 2006 in the Millennium Drought. There's change and there's a lot more coming.
And speaking of water, we're seeing low dams in the Murrumbidgee catchment and pretty low opening allocations. How are things looking for this year's rice crop for you? Will you be able to put some in?
3 or 4 weeks ago I said no. At the moment I'm 50-50 on some rice, but the temporary market's sitting on about 265 up here in the Murrumbidgee, and it's tempting to let water go at that price. It's still early days, but I've got a little bit left out. I've committed heavily on wheat, my winter program. I've got plans that can go in quickly if I need to do it, but at the moment we'll want to wait and see.
Ian Dallenberg from Murrumbidgee. I've been growing rice since 1958 and I'm still growing rice on the same original farm.
What sort of a role does rice play in your farming business and your crop rotation?
Rice has been very big in our crop rotation, and it's also been our main source of income in those areas. Everything's got to revolve around rice.
So this year, looking ahead, it's been a bit of a dry year in the catchment. You're looking to grow rice this summer?
Oh, hopefully if we get enough water, but at the present, it's a bit doubtful. I had 300 acres in last year, and this year I had water carried over from the previous year. I've got none of that now, so that might be the reason why it might be difficult to grow rice this year. I've got 90 acres prepared.
More than 65 years in this rice industry, what do you reckon's been the biggest change for you over that time?
Costs. The costs have gone through the roof, but we've gone from bulk, from bags to bulk. It's been the biggest change of the lot is the varieties that we've got. They've been brilliant, and some of them are really giving a maximum yields under the circumstances at the present.
Erin Draper, Leeton, and growing rice, since I got married to a rice grower in 1980.
So over that time, have you seen many changes in the industry?
Absolutely. And for somebody who actually was a dry area farmer's daughter, irrigation just has blown my mind, and it's just an amazing thing that we have here in the Riverina, but the rice industry is just next level up again, I think.
So in terms of rice production, how important is that as part of your cropping rotation?
You could make perhaps more money doing other things, but for us it is really good for our rotation. We do rice and seed oats, so the residual moisture from the rice gives the winter crops a boost, and it's just an amazing crop for biodiversity. It's a feel good, but it actually feels good in the pocket too, because you can make money out of it.
That is Erin Draper, who farms near Leeton in New South Wales. She's been growing rice since 1980. Australia's rice industry celebrating 100 years of commercial production. I wonder if they cheers to glass to Humpty Doo. Probably not. That's it for today's Country Hour. Keep it rural.